The second case for oral argument this morning is the Dakota Minnesota and Eastern Railroad Appellant versus Equity Mutual Insurance Company, Appalachia. For the appellant, we have Brian Donahoe and Ms. Meredith Moore, attorneys from Sioux Falls. Mr. Donahoe, I understand you'll be arguing this morning.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And for the appellee, we have Ms. Jennifer Wollman, an attorney from Sioux Falls. The court should note that Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Stephen Jensen, a circuit judge from the First Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. Also, Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Kathleen Trandall, circuit judge from the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in the place of Justice Zinner. Mr. Donahoe, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, we're here to address a summary judgment that was granted without explanation or without any further details as to the basis for the judge's decision. Summary judgment was granted on a claim for vexatious or unreasonable failure to pay an uninsured motorist claim that was brought by Dakota Minnesota and Eastern Railroad Corporation. We represent DM&E. We've represented DM&E in litigation that involved the underlying accident here since 1998 when it occurred in Rapid City, South Dakota. Just briefly, to overview the facts of the accident itself, Mr. Julian Olson was under the employ of Dakota Minnesota and Eastern Railroad, or DM&E. At the time when he went onto Interstate 90 at the eastern edge of Rapid City, going east towards Wall, and his job duty that morning was to go out to Wall where he was going to get onto railroad tracks. He was driving a pickup truck that had wheels on both the front and back that allow the pickup truck itself to go onto railroad tracks. They look like small railroad wheels, like you'd have on a railroad car. Those are called high rail wheels. Mr. Olson got onto Interstate 90, and in the only trial that determined the real facts in this case, the evidence showed that Mr. Olson came onto the interstate at a normal highway speed. He encountered a very slow-moving vehicle. Prior to Mr. Olson getting to that vehicle, two other vehicles had to avoid that slow-moving vehicle. In fact, one eyewitness, Barb Radlinger, said that that slow-moving vehicle was going so slow that it was dangerous, and in fact, it looked like it almost came to a stop in the interstate right about the time when Mr. Olson was approaching it. Mr. Olson took action to avoid that car, went out into the left-hand lane, got too far, overcorrected, ended up in the right-hand lane, then passed that lane into the ditch on the right-hand side where the pickup truck rolled over. Now, after this accident happened, Mr. Olson suffered catastrophic injuries. He was rendered quadriplegic. He has muscle spasms and extreme pain even to this day. Mr. Olson, as an employee of the railroad, brought an action under the Federal Employers Liability Act, or what we call FELA. He made a claim against the railroad, claiming that the railroad was negligent in maintaining the vehicle that he was driving. When the accident happened, it was thoroughly investigated by the railroad and its FELA liability insurer. There were witness statements that were taken. A state trooper investigated the accident, but he didn't take eyewitness statements. He didn't talk to the eyewitnesses. That state trooper was a sergeant by the name of Scott Brown. In his accident report, he simply indicated the bare facts regarding Mr. Olson's vehicle going off the road. He did not follow up and investigate, nor did he find that it was his duty to try to develop facts for a civil case. As it turned out, Mr. Olson, the victim in the accident, retained Steve Johnson as a plaintiff's attorney to bring this FELA action against the railroad. At the time, in 1998, when the investigation was complete, when the investigation involving the eyewitnesses was complete, the railroad gave notice to the liability insurance carrier covering its automobiles in this pickup truck. And that was then known as Heritage Mutual Insurance, now known as Acuity. It gave notice of the fact that it had done a full investigation. It indicated that there may be liability issues here in regard to the FELA claim, and that it may also make a claim under that policy for liability coverage under the FELA, as well as under the regular automobile coverage. No dispute about the vehicle itself being covered. The automobile damage or pickup truck damage in this case was paid in full by Acuity, then known as Heritage Mutual. As the case develops, we get closer to trial on the FELA claim. Steve Johnson at that point gives notice to the insurance company we're dealing with here, Acuity, that there will be a UM claim or a possibility of a UM claim out of this accident. And at that point, DM&E also says, we've never gotten a firm response in regard to our coverage issues. We're getting close to trial. Will you be contributing to any settlement or efforts to settle the underlying FELA claim brought by Mr. Olson? That went nowhere. Then there was a settlement during trial of the FELA claim. And it's important to note that in the FELA claim, at that trial, we had expert witnesses who established that that high rail wheel that Mr. Olson was claiming was the cause of his accident could not have come down on the interstate the way that he said, and that the only logical conclusion based on physical evidence and other testimony of witnesses was that it only came out when it was rolling over in the ditch. So what caused the accident? Acuity is going to claim that at the FELA trial, the railroad asserted that it was the contributory negligence of Mr. Olson that caused the accident. The problem with that is that it's incomplete. The testimony from the plaintiff's experts was that when the automobile was approached or was being driven on the interstate and Mr. Olson approached it, he would have had something to cause the high rail wheel to come down, and at that point, the high rail wheel was down and on the interstate highway surface, and it somehow miraculously got caught in the seam between the two lanes of the interstate and hung up there when he was trying to pass this vehicle. Our argument at trial was that it couldn't have happened that way, not only because there's got to be something to cause this wheel to come down, some kind of a jolt, because there's an actual handle that has to be released to make that come down. Mr. Olson's argument was that there was a pin that was defectively replaced by the railroad, and when that came out, the high rail wheel came down on the interstate. We claimed there had to have been some kind of jolt to cause that to happen. There was no jolt because when he came up on that vehicle, he would have had adequate time to begin to make his pass if he had been moving the way they claimed he was, which had nothing to do with trying to avoid that slow-moving vehicle. We used the same expert witness later on to make claims in the UM case. We have consistently said it didn't happen the way they said it did, that there would have had to have been something that caused the high rail wheel to come down, but it didn't come down until the jolt in the actual ditch rollover, not on the highway. Going back to the underlying underinsured motorist claim, DM&E got eyewitness statements right from the beginning saying that there was the slow-moving vehicle, that Mr. Olson had to pass it, and that he had his accident because he was trying to pass that slow-moving vehicle, which our expert determined through calculations that were easily and readily available that that vehicle was going slower than the minimum speed limit on the interstate and that was negligence. And
did you supply that information directly to the UM carrier?
We put them on notice of it. We asked them to take a look at this evidence. And what they did, in fact, was they went to Steve Johnson, the plaintiff's attorney, and looked at his evidence. He had the same evidence, but they apparently only looked at selected parts of it or looked at it in light of his arguments, which were totally avoiding that set of facts. Mr. Olson's claim was that the high rail wheel came down and therefore he had nothing, no reason to pursue negligence of the unidentified driver, that this accident happened because that high rail wheel got caught when he was making a regular turn from one lane to the other, or a regular passing maneuver, I should say, from one lane to the other. So he was staying away from any negligence of the unidentified driver. And there's a good reason for that on behalf of Mr. Olson. There's only $1 million in policy coverage under the uninsured motorist claim. If he establishes the negligence of a third party, it takes away from his negligence of the railroad. He can't go after the railroad, which has a much deeper pocket. So Mr. Olson's attorney has certain facts which he provides. I don't know what was investigated here because we never had an opportunity to find out what investigation was done.
But there is no judge or jury that's ever made a determination then as to which version of the facts was more credible because of the settlement?
On the Thiele case, there was a settlement, but there was a judge and jury that made a decision on the uninsured motorist claim. We went to trial, and that was decided in our favor, clearly establishing, after a very short deliberation by the jury, that the unidentified driver caused the accident. No contributory negligence by Mr. Olson. Furthermore, there was no expert witness put on by Acuity in that case. We've had expert witnesses from the beginning. What happened was, as this case progressed and we got closer to getting some kind of a jury verdict on the issue of the unidentified motorist coverage, it was clear that we had some issues here as to what happened and why Acuity never properly investigated the claim, or if they did, why they ignored certain facts that seemed to be very clear to us. We asked to amend our complaint to add the bad faith claim or vexatious failure to pay. We were allowed to do that, and then we brought a motion to compel. There was a subpoena of attorneys on behalf of Acuity, and the reason why we sought testimony from the attorneys is very clear. In the deposition of the claims manager handling this, a fellow by the name of Tom Barron testified that he was the only one in charge of this claim on behalf of Acuity. He totally relied on the attorneys for the investigation and then on their legal opinions for what to do next. And in fact, it's very clear from the brief of Acuity that Mr. Barron relied on their legal conclusions instead of facts, instead of an investigation, even as this case progressed and we got closer to a trial whereby it was apparent that there was an issue of fact. Summary judgment was brought by Acuity and denied.
Why didn't you take the deposition of Mr. Timpson?
We tried. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you got the court's permission to do it. The court ordered it to be done.
We tried to pursue that, but then there was the issue of whether we had to proceed with a bifurcated trial or not to establish whether there was negligence on the uninsured driver. We did voluntarily agree to bifurcate, went forward on the negligence issue. Then, instead of pressing that issue, which in hindsight perhaps we should have done, we asked if they would please get substitute counsel and get a scheduling order in place. We couldn't do a scheduling order until they got substitute counsel. Our assumption was that they would have substitute counsel so that we could take the deposition of Mr. Timpson, because someone would have to represent the company in that deposition. That never happened.
But it seems to me like you dropped the ball. You got an order to compel the deposition of Timpson and James Moore, who represented Hi-Rail, and you never took the depositions, even though you had a court order to do it. Now, I mean, and if you did drop the ball, then now it seems you're coming to us to ask for help.
Well, there was no issue. There was nothing we could do further in regard to discovery because...
Oh, yeah. How about bad faith?
Well, in regard to the bad faith, that's what we're talking about. We asked for requests for admissions. Every single one of those were answered with an objection based on attorney-client privilege, attorney work product, or some other opinion, or some other privilege based on the representation of counsel. That was before the summary judgment. We raised that issue with the trial court on summary judgment and said, we have to have further discovery on this case. It's premature.
But then you acquiesced in the answer, which to me was a crock. I mean, if you could have taken the deposition, you know, the insurance company or the adjuster is the actor, and whether or not he was in bad faith depends on what he knew and when he knew it, right?
Correct.
Okay. And he's claiming a defense on bad faith on the basis of the attorney's work product and that he just got this opinion from the attorney. Well, then the insurance company's hired an agent, so then you have to find out what the attorney knew and what facts he investigated, don't you? Because that's what determines bad faith.
That's correct, Your Honor. But had the jury determined that there was no negligence by the unidentified driver, at that point, those issues would be much different in regard to what the insurance company knew and when they knew it.
Because you're setting up a hypothetical that didn't happen.
Well, it didn't. In regard to the chronology here, Your Honor, there was a bifurcation in order to determine the liability issues. Then immediately after that, when we tried to proceed with discovery, we were met with a brick wall. There was no effort to replace counsel. And when we proceeded, there was some settlement negotiations. When we proceeded to try to get the scheduling order in place, instead they brought the motion for summary judgment. We resisted the motion for summary judgment on the basis that we needed to do this discovery and on the basis that clearly there's a genuine issue of material fact that's in dispute here.
You could have tried for an intermediate appeal once you got, I mean, you had an order for discovery, and they set up a brick wall on it, and then the court went ahead with summary judgment, and before that happened, or from the summary judgment order, you could have taken an intermediate appeal on the basis that they were refusing to allow the depositions.
But at that point, the only thing left was the issue of bad faith, which is what we're here for today. The summary judgment ended everything. The only issue remaining was the bad faith. We tried to pursue discovery on that. They brought a motion for summary judgment. The summary judgment was granted, and that ended the case. It was a judgment on all issues because the only thing remaining at that point was the bad faith. And that's what we're here today for. So there was nothing in between where we could have brought an interlocutory appeal.
What exactly would you, so that, I mean, I have the proposed and the findings of fact, but maybe just to help me clear this up a little bit, what material facts do you think are in dispute that makes your case survive summary judgment?
If we go to the core issue of what was reasonable in this case, they're claiming it was fairly debatable, and as a matter of law, there's no way that any reasonable jury could find bad faith. Our issue is very clear. When the letter was written by Mr. Timpson, the attorney for Acuity, who did the only investigation in the case, he missed key eyewitness statements. Then, apparently, based on the decision that there was not going to be coverage here and that it was going to be denied because there weren't eyewitnesses to corroborate that, Mr. Timpson's letter says that. There's no eyewitnesses to corroborate the way that the accident happened.
How did the judge not take those in the light most favorable to you?
I'm totally baffled, Your Honor. This came at the end of the hearing. The judge merely said, I'm going to rule in favor of the defendants in this case, and that was it. No rationale. The transcript is devoid of any further explanation, and we were flabbergasted. Frankly, had I had any idea that we were going to have, as a general run-of-the-mill summary judgment case, this one looked like a flat-out winner because we had all kinds of disputes about material facts. And then going forward, there's absolutely nothing in the record to establish that they reconsidered their position after they found out that they didn't have the facts back in 2000 when they blew it on the essential issue of whether there was eyewitnesses or not. Fast forward at the end of the bifurcated trial, when they got slammed on negligence, what do? They appealed to this court and were unanimously affirmed on the negligence of the unidentified driver. And at that point, they finally pay. We turn around and say, look, we still have a bad faith issue. We've got to have these issues resolved. And the only response, there was some settlement negotiations, I have to admit that, but the only other response is it's all attorney-client privilege. So apparently there was never, ever any independent investigation. They never brought in a third-party attorney or anybody else to review whether the original opinion, which they stuck by throughout, should have been reevaluated. And that's what we assert is clearly a disputed issue of material fact.
Is that standard review of 2020 hindsight one because the jury didn't agree with them?
Well, frankly, I think the jury's decision really supports our case. But having said that, they have an ongoing duty to reevaluate as they get closer to the trial. And I would argue that the fact that they didn't even use an expert on liability, an expert witness, when the same law firm used our experts in defending the manufacturer of the high rail equipment in a separate product liability claim, there's something there that begs the question of whether or not there should have been a further evaluation of this case before it went to trial. Then the trial decision just cements it.
Is the law then, if we take the facts and the law of this case as the court has analyzed it, the lower court, if you take the facts most favorable to your side, what the ruling then would say is that the rule of law is that they don't have an obligation.
Absolutely. It would say there's a bright line rule. If there's some debatable argument that they can present to get them to a jury, there's no bad faith ever, regardless of how egregious those underlying facts may be, regardless of how thin that debatable issue might be. As long as they can come up with some thin reed, they will then avoid bad faith on any case going forward if this judgment stands.
Who decides whether it's a debatable issue? Is that a jury question in itself?
Absolutely, that would be a jury question, Justice Meyer-Henry. The reason why is because it's all about facts. Here we've got a decision on whether it would be fairly debatable from a legal standpoint. You can have expert witnesses who are going to address this, who can say what's reasonable for an insurance company. They totally relied on their own trial counsel. Is that reasonable? And the jury will decide that.
Did you argue to Judge Tim that it was premature to even consider summary judgment at the point where you have not completed the deposition of the attorney, Gary Timpson?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's in the transcript from the summary judgment hearing.
Did you get an order denying that?
No, we did not.
Okay. You could have taken or tried to take an intermediate appeal based on that. So there is a process there where you could have. You may not have gotten it. I concede that. We don't grant many.
I don't know that I could have. Actually, the way this tracks, Your Honor, there was a motion to compel, and I see I'm 10 seconds away from losing my time here, but there was a motion to compel. That was granted by Judge Tim. We didn't get that information to the fullest extent we needed, so we subpoenaed Timpson and James Moore, his partner. There was a motion to quash. That motion to quash was denied. And there was an attempt on the underlying appeal of the negligence case to address the quashing of that subpoena, and that was determined to be premature by this court. So we still had a good, valid subpoena. The issue was, would these attorneys please get off the case so that we can get other attorneys involved and go forward? We would have had to renew our motion to quash, or I'm sorry, renew our motion to enforce the subpoenas at that point, and then try to bring an interlocutory appeal if it was denied. But the issue at that point was not whether they were going to give the testimony. The issue was whether they had this legal right to summary judgment, regardless of what their testimony was going to be.
But when you say please, and they say go fly a kite, then you got to do something with it, don't you? You can't say please again or expect any results.
I respectfully have to disagree, Justice Savers, because at that point, when you're in settlement negotiations and you're getting along, there didn't seem to be a real issue about whether or not the subpoenas were valid and they were eventually going to testify. The issue was whether or not, under this bright-line rule that they're proposing, whether they went as a matter of law, which would negate the need for their testimony. So they brought the summary judgment motion. We went along on that issue to the extent that we still disputed that it was allowable as summary judgment at that point because it was premature and we needed this testimony. But there really wasn't something that was denied to us that would have compelled us to take action.
Your time is up, but Judge Jameson has a question.
I just had the question of along Justice Saber's question, which is Rule 56F says that there's an affidavit you can file requesting time to do discovery. Did you make that request by affidavit?
Not separately by affidavit, but in our affidavit of counsel, we did submit the evidence relating to their application of the attorney-client privilege and work product defenses, which squarely puts the issue of their representation and the insurance company's reliance on counsel as a defense at issue. Because up to this point, they're still denying that the insurance company is relying on defensive counsel as or advice of counsel as a defense.
Hey, your time has expired. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
General.
You.
Ms. Woolman, you have 20 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I am here today on behalf of Acuity to ask that this court affirm Judge Tim's decision granting our motion for summary judgment on DM&E's bad faith claim. Judge Tim correctly granted summary judgment in this case because no genuine issues of material fact exist. The facts in this case are undisputed. Judge Tim presided over the uninsured motorist litigation since it was filed in 2001. He presided over a two-day-long jury trial back in January of 2005. He properly decided on this record that the bad faith claim should not go to the jury. This court's standard of review this case involves a question of law. Under the Fenn v. Progressive Insurance case, this case presents a question of whether the facts constitute bad faith. As this court reviews the
Do you conclude then that the facts taken in the light most favorable would be that the attorneys, Tempson being mentioned here earlier, did not investigate properly. Don't we have to assume that that's the fact in the light most favorable?
Your Honor, while on summary judgment the facts should be construed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, I think here we're presented with very specific legal standards in this state on bad faith. The question is whether there is a fairly debatable issue, not whether the decision was correct or incorrect. And I think that DM&E here is arguing that Mr. Timpson's August 1, 2000 letter to Acuity, which is in the record, somehow contained incorrect facts. Granted, it does state that there was no evidence or no witnesses to corroborate an unidentified vehicle. Clearly, that issue is beside the point at this time. Clearly, that's been conceded a long time ago. But the issue remains is what facts does Mr. Timpson state in that letter? He clearly states that Trooper Brown, Scott Brown's accident report contained no evidence of any contributing circumstances of an unidentified vehicle. It does reference a slower-moving vehicle. And contrary to what DM&E argues today, the accident report does refer to eyewitness statements that Trooper Brown talked to. That's Holly and Richard Shoesmith. The Shoesmiths, their testimony, we have their testimony from the FELA trial. We have their testimony in the uninsured motorist action. And their testimony showed, as indicated in Mr. Timpson's letter, that there was a slower-moving vehicle that Mr. Olson was passing, that they saw Mr. Olson's car swerve, lose control, and end up in the ditch and rolled. Now, DM&E claims that because Mr. Timpson did not mention the recorded statement of Barbara Ravinger in that letter, somehow is evidence of bad faith. That's wrong. DM&E admits that they provided notice to Acuity of all the evidence they felt was favorable to them. Acuity knew about the recorded statement of Barbara Ravinger. It knew about the Shoesmith statements. It had Trooper Scott Brown's accident report.
But how do we know what Acuity knew and when the discovery on Mr. Tim's deposition, as Timpson's deposition, has not been taken? The request for admissions was flatly objected to on every question that they asked. So how do we know when Acuity knew what when that discovery has not been completed?
Judge Trandall, to answer that question, I think we need to look at what discovery DM&E did do. Clearly, DM&E deposed Tom Barron, the claims representative of Acuity that handled this claim.
But didn't he just say he relied on counsel?
Your Honor, he went beyond that. Mr. Barron and his deposition testimony is in the record. DM&E asked specific questions on what evidence or information did you have on the uninsured motorist claim. Mr. Barron clearly testified that he had all the information from the underlying FELA action. He knew about eyewitness statements, deposition testimony, trial testimony, and Trooper Scott Brown's accident report. Mr. Barron felt that that was the best evidence. This, and his deposition was taken in 2004. So DM&E did have an opportunity to do discovery and depose Mr. Barron. They also deposed Steve Johnson, Julian Olson's attorney. I also want to direct the court to the fact that I believe the correct date we need to be looking at for purposes of whether Acuity had a reasonable basis to deny the uninsured motorist claim is July 23rd of 2001.
Now, you say correct date. Mr. Donahoe says that you have an ongoing obligation, or Acuity does, to reevaluate as facts unfold. Do you agree with that?
Your Honor, I would agree with that, and I think that that was done. This is a case that began in 2001, and DM&E argues that Acuity should have reevaluated its position, its denial, looked at all the facts and evidence. As more information became available in discovery in the litigation of the uninsured motorist claim, clearly that was done in this record. By July 23 of 2001, it is not disputed that Acuity had all the information from the underlying FELA claim from Mr. Johnson, Julian Olson's attorney. Mr. Johnson is the one that gave Acuity notice of a potential uninsured motorist claim back in May of 2000. And I believe that July 23, 2001 is the correct date to be looking at here. And that's when litigation began. The parties were represented. Judge Tim found in the uninsured motorist case that was the date, the most clearly identifiable date that DM&E gave Acuity demand or notice of an uninsured motorist claim in this court in DM&E.
So then are you retracting your position with Justice Gilbertson that they don't have an ongoing responsibility to reevaluate?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Okay, you're still agreeing to that. So why is 2001 the end time?
Your Honor.
Instead of 2002, 2003, 2004.
Yes, Your Honor, you're right. It is ongoing, and our position is that ongoing the entire time as information became developed through litigation, the basic facts of the accident have not changed. And if we look at what further information became available as discovery and litigation continued, if you want to look at from the 1998 accident, from the date May 1, 2000, whatever date, the more information that became available, I believe the more reasonable it is that this was a fairly debatable issue. Because the question was whether an unidentified vehicle, we know it existed, but the question was whether that vehicle was negligent, and if so, whether that negligence caused Olson's accident. That's a negligence question.
Do you claim that, you stick to that position even after the trial of the uninsured motorist case, where there was a substantial verdict in favor of DM&E?
Your Honor, I think the key point on that is that, I mean, hindsight is 20/20, but Judge Tim clearly allowed the uninsured motorist question to go to the jury. And to do so, he must have found that inferences could be drawn from the evidence. And the law in South Dakota is whether a fairly debatable issue existed. Is there evidence to support that the question was fairly debatable? And I think if DM&E argues to this court that Acuity should somehow have placed more emphasis on its facts that it relied upon or weighed them in a different manner, I think that goes against the law of fairly debatable, because if...
Well, how do we know what they did rely on?
Mr. Barron's deposition testimony shows what he relied on. He had all the information, and the issue is when...
Well, that's a generality. Tell me specifically, what did they rely on to make that decision? Is that in the record enough for us to even look at?
Your Honor, Mr. Barron testified in his deposition that he relied upon its attorneys. It's counsel.
And we don't know what the attorneys told them, because that has not been, they've not been able to proceed with that. So isn't this kind of, aren't we going around in circles?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Mr. Barron testified that he relied upon attorneys who obtained documents regarding the underlying FELA case, that they obtained witness statements, deposition testimony, and that Mr. Barron felt that that was the best evidence. And...
But what was that evidence? That's my question. What facts did they have to make the decision other than they relied on their attorneys?
Your Honor, I go back to Mr. Barron's deposition testimony. He knew about Barbara Ratlinger's statements. He knew about the Shoesmiths. He knew about deposition testimony from the litigation that went back and forth between DM&E and Mr. Olson himself. Mr. Barron also knew about Trooper Scott Brown's investigative report. He knew that back in 1998 when the case first came in. He also, Your Honor, knew that the FELA case was settled. he knew all of that information. He felt that was the best evidence. This was an unusual case, and I do believe this case is an anomaly because we have now going on 9 years of litigation that stemmed from Julian Olson's accident. And from the very beginning, it's in the record, Mr. Donahoe's letters to Acuity in 1998 said, "We've discussed the facts of the case. This was a one-vehicle accident. They gave notice that they were of a property damage claim. And it was Mr. Olson's attorney that gave notice of a potential uninsured motorist claim." The more information that Acuity learned through discovery as this case proceeded only supports that there is a reasonable basis to dispute this claim. Mr. Johnson was deposed by DM&E, and Mr. Johnson himself testified he saw no reasonable basis to go after an unidentified driver. He felt there was no legitimate basis to do so. And if Mr. Olson's own attorney decided not to go after the unidentified vehicle, I think that only further supports that this was a fairly debatable issue, subject to dispute.
Let me go back to Barron's deposition. Does he specifically testify that he was aware of Shoesmith and Radlinger's statements in the deposition?
I believe he does say, and if I'm mistaken, I'll stand corrected, but I do believe he did testify that he knew that those statements existed. And DM&E today admitted that they gave notice to Acuity of that information.
And then going back to Justice Meyer Henry's earlier question to plaintiff's counsel in the case, the fairly debatable issue, let's say there's two versions of how this accident occurred. Who makes the determination whether it's fairly debatable? Is that a jury question or is that a question for the court?
Well, here, Your Honor, we don't have two different versions of how the accident happened. Those facts have not changed. And if we're looking at the uninsured motorist case...
Well, isn't that what the uninsured motorist case was about? There were two versions of how Mr. Olson was injured in the accident. He was either injured by the high rail system and or his own negligence, or he was injured by the negligence of some unidentified driver. So you have those two theories. If it's fairly debatable, who makes that decision? What, is it a jury question or is it a court question?
Your Honor, it's a court question. It's a question for the court because under the Fenn case, this court said that the question is whether the facts constitute bad faith. And here, the issue is, did DM&E show any genuine issues of material fact? It hasn't. In response to your question, Judge Jensen, DM&E never filed a Rule 56F affidavit to argue summary judgment shouldn't be entered. They never filed an affidavit showing specific facts that would go to form a genuine issue of material fact. And I think that's key. What further discovery could DM&E have done? First, they have not shown any evidence or told us what discovery would do, what would be relevant. And here, I think under Rule 56, summary judgment need await for completion of discovery. And I think that's key in this case because that would undermine the very purpose of the summary judgment rule. I think the Supreme Court has said many times that if there exists any basis in the record to support the trial court's decision, this court will affirm on summary judgment. And DM&E argues that somehow adopting the Judge Chin's decision on summary judgment will create a suspect bright line rule. I think that's wrong. And Belleville is the case from Iowa, 2005, Iowa Supreme Court, that both parties do rely on and discuss in their briefs. That case did not advocate for a directed verdict rule. All it said is that it's relevant, and it's certainly something to consider under the facts and circumstances of each case. And Belleville also said that it's important to look at whether if the insured was entitled to a directed verdict on liability on the underlying uninsured motorist case. That's certainly relevant. Here, we don't have that. Judge Tim clearly decided that this uninsured motorist action should go to the jury because issues of fact existed. Inferences could be drawn from those facts. That's relevant here. That is a basis to support Judge Tim's decision on summary judgment.
But aren't you asking this court to depart from its general rule that determination of whether an insurer properly investigated a claim is a question of fact?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe we're departing from that rule. I believe here DM&E has not shown how, has not offered any evidence or case law to support its argument that an insurer's reliance on counsel for an investigation in facts of this case where the case is already being litigated, they have not offered any evidence or case law or authorities to support that argument.
But then the circle comes back. They were not given the opportunity to complete the discovery, so how are they supposed to prove facts when they haven't had the opportunity to do everything that they need to do prior to summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, they certainly had an opportunity to submit a Rule 56F affidavit to tell Judge Tim why, but they didn't. They have an obligation on summary judgment to come up with more than conclusory allegations and unsupported allegations.
But to put the shoe on the other foot, you are part of the team that just stonewalled them on all that. They had an order to take a deposition, and you didn't cooperate. So, and now you're turning around and saying, well, they didn't file another request. I mean, how many requests do you need when the judge has already ruled in your favor?
Your Honor, I don't believe we stonewalled on that at all. The issue of the bad...
There weren't any depositions taken, were there? And the judge said that they could take them.
That's correct, Your Honor. No depositions were taken because Mr. Donahoe never requested them. The bad faith claim was bifurcated from the uninsured motorist case, and then it went to the jury. After the jury...
And they in fact did a favor to your firm then, so that, and to your client, so that they didn't have to go get different counsel to try that underlying case. True?
Your Honor, I have to disagree with that. There is not a motion for disqualification that it wasn't before the trial court, and I don't believe it's properly before this court because Judge Tim didn't have an opportunity to ever consider that. DM&E could have filed a motion for disqualification, but it didn't. And under the facts of this case...
But wait a minute. Disqualification, if that's appropriate, under the rules of ethics, would have to come from the attorneys themselves. I mean, we are not going to put a rule here that the other side has to file a motion for disqualification when it's clear. I mean, that's the obligation of the attorney. And in a bad faith case, that's almost... Rule 101, isn't it? I mean, you always do that. If there's bad faith, the attorney gets off because they know they could be witnesses. In this case, that didn't happen. Why not?
Your Honor, I would agree with you that attorney does have an obligation to disqualify if they feel that is required. But what I was trying to say is that this court has said motions for disqualification can be filed. Obviously, that was one avenue. That's in the Rumstead v. Donneler Enterprises case. But here...
Do you concede that in this case, even though Attorney Timpson issued an opinion to the insurance company, he in fact was a fact witness as to anything he investigated as to the bad faith issue? He's a fact witness, not an expert witness. Or else he's both.
Your Honor, Mr. Timpson would probably be a witness. A fact witness as to what...
And you're claiming he did not drag his feet? He didn't stonewall anybody? How much time went by from the time the order was drawn that he should make his deposition available until the time he moved to quash that order?
Your Honor, as I stand here, I do not know the answer to that question.
Was it months?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor, and I apologize.
Your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Donahoe, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to briefly address a few legal issues and then go to some factual matters. In regard to the legal issues, it was the Waltz case and that's Walsh versus Fireman's Fund Insurance Company, in which this court said, quote, whether insurer acted in bad faith in conducting an inadequate investigation or failing to review case law is a question of fact for the jury or other trier of fact. The issue is determined based on the facts and law available to insurer at the time it made the decision to deny coverage. So in regard to the issues here, as we stated before, those are fact issues that should go to the jury if there's a disputed issue of material fact. When it came to the summary judgment here, frankly, I'd like to take full responsibility for the procedural things that Justice Sabers was concerned about in regard to not bringing a motion to disqualify or a motion to request additional time under Rule 56F. What we did was we filed plaintiff's response to defendant's statement of undisputed material facts. We laid out additional undisputed facts which addressed that issue. And there was no dispute about the fact that there is a valid subpoena out there and that we needed to do additional additional discovery by testimony of the witnesses. At that point in time, our requests for admissions were still pending. We had been doing written discovery. We just got the request for admission responses, and every single one of those did not admit, did not deny, but instead relied on the attorney-client privilege or work product privilege to thwart our efforts to determine that. We presented that to the court by way of an affidavit of counsel. At that point, Justice Sabers, I think things were ripe for us to go forward on a motion to compel or do something further, but that was while the summary judgment motion was pending.
Okay.
So we argued.
Can you answer the question as to how long it was from the time you got the order from the court to for the defense to make their attorneys available for deposition to the time they came back in and moved to quash it?
Yes, Your Honor. What happened was that was ongoing at the time when we were deciding whether to bifurcate the trial on the negligence issues. And so what in fact happened was we made the motion to compel and we got the subpoenas. They made a motion to quash. The motion to quash was denied before we actually had the negligence trial. And in August of 2000, we brought forth some of these issues, and the argument presented by the attorneys for Woods, Fuller, Schultz, and Smith was that our attempt to bring the amendment and our attempt to seek their discovery was an attempt to get them off the case and to improperly disqualify them. And that's what gave rise to the bifurcation.
They're saying in substance it was a motion to disqualify.
And we ended up with a bifurcation, which we did by agreement because we wanted to get to the underlying issue and get the policy limits.
Is this the last time you're ever going to be a nice guy in a lawsuit?
I'm afraid it is, Your Honor, unfortunately. And in response to some of the factual issues that were raised, I just need to point out, in the deposition of Tom Barron, this is in the record, there are two separate affidavits of counsel, one from the plaintiff's side, one from the defense side, which put his entire transcript into the record. But on page 21, Mr. Barron was asked these questions on, this is November 5th of 2004, long before we get to the other issues that were determined in our favor. Question, what evidence have you reviewed, if any, in regard to this particular lawsuit as to the negligence of the unidentified driver? Answer, information received from our attorneys. Question, do you remember what that was? Answer, not the details. The essence is what I described as the causation in the FELA loss. Question, what about expert witness reports in this case? Have you reviewed any of those? Answer, I personally, no. Question, has anyone from Acuity reviewed any expert witness reports in this case? Answer, as indicated, all the investigation and review of that evidence was performed by our attorneys. Question, is there any kind of policy book or handbook in regard to how these UM claims are handled? Answer, not that I'm aware of. Question, are there any industry standards or some kind of a code or anything like that that is used by the insurance industry for investigation and determination of UM claims? Answer, there may be, but I'm not aware of it. Question, did anyone else from Acuity or Heritage Mutual work on the UM portion of this claim by Julian or for Julian Olson's injuries? Answer, no. Question, just so I'm clear then, this would have been solely handled by you, Tom Barron, and the attorneys for Heritage Mutual and Acuity. Answer, when we received the notice from Steve Johnson of the potential UM claim, that was referred to our attorneys for investigation and determination. Question, What about after the actual lawsuit was filed by, in this case, GM&E against the insurance company for UM coverage and for the UM benefits? Answer, are you asking if Acuity did any independent investigation or question? Yes. Answer, all the investigation was done by our attorneys. Question, did anyone else from Acuity work on the case besides yourself? Answer, no. Question, is there any kind of a report or anything that you do to your to any of your superiors in regard to this particular litigation and whether there is, in fact, any responsibility on the part of Acuity to pay UM benefits? Answer, no formal report, no. We have all that in the evidence at the summary judgment. We argued to the judge there's a genuine issue of material fact, whether they investigated this properly at the beginning or ever reevaluated their position throughout the entire case. We felt at that point in time that we had done the right thing. This is a situation where I have to say on the record, co-counsel with me, one of my partners, is the sister of one of the people we looked to depose here, James Moore. It's a delicate situation. We tried to handle it the best we could. I personally take responsibility for that. I would appreciate it if the court would please not hold that against my client's interests. We thought we were doing the right thing.
But James Moore didn't have anything to do with the defense of work product, the defense of bad faith, or the defense of he dealt with Hi-Rail, right?
He dealt with Hi-Rail, and he used the same expert witness, or I should say one of the same expert witnesses that the railroad used in the underlying FELA case. And the issue there is, what was discussed about the potential conflict of interest or the use of the same law firm going forward to press forward on the same issues which they had used in the opposite way on a different case? In other words, what communications between these two law partners took place at that law firm, if any, and did they reevaluate the case? Because it would make sense that one law partner would say to the other, hey, you know, our expert witness, Al Knott, that we used to defend on the product liability claim is the one the railroad used to say there's no negligence on the part of the DM&E and the accident was caused by the negligence of some third party. That would be critical, I would think, to assess the liability issues here for Acuity and whether they got a fair shake or not. This all goes back to what standard needs to be applied in summary judgment on a first-party bad faith claim. The insured here is providing coverage that's required by state statute. There's a public policy that says you've got to have this insurance because we have people out there who may not have insurance. You better have coverage for when you get in an accident and those folks out there who don't have insurance can't pay you. In that situation, there is certainly an issue between the insured and the insurer as to whose rights should be paramount when it comes to pushing one set of facts against another, and maybe there's an equal balance. But if there's an ambiguity or if there's a decision to be made there, it should be made in favor of the insured, not the insurer. And we've got a case here where the insurer is allowed to not only ignore certain facts, not do an investigation, but then turn around and say, if I can find anything in the process of litigating on a negligence claim to hang my hat on, to say I've got a fairly debatable issue, then I'm good to go. I don't have to ever pay the policy at all until the jury says I have to and they pry it out of my hands.
You know, it's almost like the insurance company is attempting to stick their head in the sand, pass everything to their attorney, and then defend or hide behind the fact that there's an attorney-client privilege and it's all work product, and that can't be the law, that someone can get by with that.
I would certainly argue that it is not the law, Justice Sabers. And again, this is a difficult procedural case, and there are a lot of facts to try to follow here, but that's even more reason why they should have reevaluated things along the way and said, hey, this is crazy. Why are we paying all these attorneys all this money to fight about all this stuff? Maybe there ought to be some point where we compromise and say, there's facts here that could go either way. And if there are, then we better pay on the policy. It's a public policy. It's a state law thing that we're providing here. So that's our argument, and that's why we feel that summary judgment should be denied in this case. And we ask that you be very careful about how you determine these issues because it will impact a lot of small businesses and individuals as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dano. We'll be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.